Excellent. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Amy H. Sturgis, and welcome to this thesis theater, this celebration for Laurel M. Stevens. It has been my delight and my honor to work with Laurel, and I am very pleased to introduce you to a truly cutting-edge, important, and fascinating thesis, An Awareness of Debt's Dark Academia and Its Source Texts. Laurel M. Stevens completed her undergraduate work in English at Westminster College, where she first delved into fantasy studies with J.R.R. Tolkien. Her master's coursework at Signum University focused on imaginative literature and has allowed her to explore fantasy at greater depths and introduced her to areas of study such as adaptation and our topic at hand, dark academia. She reads and reviews heavily in modern fantasy and science fiction, but remains interested in a wide range of literature. And now it is my privilege to present Laurel M. Stevens. Laurel, take it away.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Dr. Sturgis. And although my topic is on dark academia, it would be remiss of me to not say thank you. In awareness of my own debts, thank you to Signum very much for the opportunity to present this, and Dr. Sturgis, who guided me through my thesis process. It was a joy. Now, the title of my thesis is actually from one of the books in my thesis, and it is, "She was acutely aware of the debts she owed others. She felt sometimes like that debt had been carved into her bones." And I felt that not only was that paying homage to the fact that I'm looking primarily at modern texts that are pulling heavily from classic and texts and borrowing, but also it very much gives the vibe of dark academia carved into her bones. Now, when I say dark academia, I want to make sure that we're all on the same page before I actually begin diving into the specifics of what it is that I was identifying in the text I was looking at. Because dark academia is indeed a genre, but also if you type dark academia into a search engine, you're going to get more than just books popping up, because it's also an aesthetic. So you're going to see pictures of plaid, elbow patches, those soaring Gothic arches that you see in cathedrals and older buildings, dark colors. You may even see things like pictures of recent shows like Wednesday or perhaps Penny Dreadful. When I say dark academia here, I only mean the genre term. And of course, the literary term does relate tangentially to the aesthetic. They both rely on darker tones, but the aesthetic is largely visual, and I'm talking about what we're finding in the text here today. So now that that's clarified, dark academia as a genre has only fairly recently begun to receive critical consideration. You can find some scholarly papers using the term, but not a large swath. One of the more recent ones that came out in 2022 was On Nostalgia and Dark Academia by scholar Marion Nguyen, and she has a definition in her paper of dark academia as a genre of nostalgic academic fantasy that structurally draws on campus novels and thriller murder mysteries and extrapolates its aesthetic effects from the Gothic. Now, that also has other words in it you may not be familiar with, like campus novels. And campus novels and academic novels are often grouped together, but they are two separate things. Jeffrey J. Williams wrote in the article, "The Rise of the Academic Novel," the exact difference is an academic novel depicts the world of adult academics and has merged quite a bit with what the ideal middle class experience of academia is imagined to be. Whereas the campus novel focuses more on young adults coming of age within the world of academics. Both are definitely within the world of academia, and both do now relate to the genre of dark academia, although campus and academic novels specifically predate the dark academia trend. Now, exploring some of the predecessors of dark academia, such as the campus and academic novels, Dr. Elaine Showalter has a book called Faculty Towers. It was published in the early 2000s. And she gave a solid overview of the evolution of academic novels all the way from the 1950s up to the start of the 21st century. And with this wide survey, she noted that oftentimes, a lot of the novels that were being published, if they were addressing any particular issues in academia, they lagged quite a bit behind the actual emergence of these issues. And I'm going to cycle back a little bit on this topic when I once again bring up the fact that academic novels are not all dark academia, but all dark academia novels are definitely academic novels. But to Dr. Showalter, even as early as 2005, it was obvious that there was a trend in academic novels that they were responding to the decline of ideals seen in the academic setting, but also to larger issues as a whole that could be seen in the institution. And those trends that she was following are now an integral part of what I consider to be dark academia. And now we also have Dr. Sturgis's recently published essay, Dr. Dark Arts and Secret Histories, Investigating Dark Academia. And in this, she gave an overview of not only the active conversation of what dark academia as a genre is doing, but also what the genre is a result of. And she listed four different things that she considers to be necessary for a work to be considered dark academia. And these four topics are very generally academia, which makes sense, it's in the name, the gothic, which I will definitely be diving more in depth into, mood, and critique. And those last two may seem a little vague. Don't worry, I will give a much clearer definition of those. And as I said, academia is fairly straightforward. It can be part of the setting, the character, the theme. So these are things like explorations of learning, libraries, laboratories, culture, or actual physical scholarly institutions like universities and schools. Now, the Gothic has a wide variety of definitions, but the four elements of Gothic that you see most often in dark academia and that I'm relying on, Sturgis actually highlighted from Gerald E. Hogel's Introduction to the Cambridge Companion of Gothic Fiction. And it's 4 points. One, it's Gothic. It has a story rooted in setting, especially in antiquated space or time. Two, a tight focus or obsession with the past. Three, an association with secrecy or secrets. And four, blurring the boundary between reality and the supernatural. So all of those are the most common Gothic elements that we see in dark academia. That doesn't mean that a dark academia work has to utilize all of these, they're just the ones that tend to trend higher. The Gothic does also rely on strongly othering either places or characters. Now, this can be narrators, observers, physical objects, and places. And it's worth noting that in her work on nostalgia and dark academia, Nguyen also explicitly states that her understanding of dark academia relies on the Gothic. So we've covered academia, we've covered Gothic. Time for mood. Now, mood is a really general term. A lot of the times when I'm describing this to people, I also use the word vibe. Because what you're looking for here is what ties into the dark part of the dark academia genre. So when I say mood, I'm saying there's a heavy emphasis on things like obsession, death, controversy, destruction, anything dark that contributes to the atmospheric difference between a general academic novel and a dark academia novel. Now, last, but definitely not least, we get to critique. Now, the critique element is what I think is one of the more important things that distinguishes dark academia from general campus or academia lit. Because literary dark academia works have a critical structure to them. Now, it could be that the author is actually interrogating the academic structure that exists within the novel, or it could be a commentary on elitism in general, the silencing of voices, any of the multiple issues that are present in the real world that tend to be brought into stark relief when they occur in the microcosm that is academia. Now, the dark academia works that I'm digging into in my work make use of pre-existing and primarily already Gothic works. And the Gothic is something that is often recycled or reimagined in multiple ways. Dracula and Frankenstein have many lives in pop culture. And there's dozens of active conversations going on in academia and scholarship on how the Gothic has been reimagined or reinvented. One of the more common terms I've seen when I look up Gothic adaptation and reimagination is remixed or mashed up. Now, there was an essay collection I relied on quite heavily, and this by De Bruyn Mol that was all about Frankenfictions and mashups, and it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to look at any of the Gothic works that the essays were exploring. But the way that De Bruyn Mol was having all of her contributors ask, Why are we specifically reimagining the Gothic? That was the kind of question I wanted to take and apply to the dark academia works I was looking at. I wanted to ask why dark academia, in the same way that remixes and mashups often ask why Gothic? So this is when authors intentionally bring pre-existing elements from a text to a new format, whether that's another text, a TV show, a game, etc. Now, these original texts that they're bringing the elements from, it's going to be both Gothic and non, but a lot of the research I was looking at specifically targeted Gothic. They echo demands and questions in the same way that a lot of recent dark academia works that utilize classical source echoes the demands and questions that exist in that source already. And as dark academia intertwines closely with the Gothic, I thought many of the elements brought forward in that analysis related quite well to looking at dark academia. So now that I've given you a definition of dark academia, some details on the four elements that I consider necessary for a work to be considered a work of dark academia, we can explore some of the questions that I was looking into in my thesis. So one of the very big ones first was what and why? Because like I said, if you type dark academia into a search engine, you're going to get so many different results. Now, if you type dark academia novels, obviously that's going to get you majority literature. And some of the examples that you can see on the slide here are The Secret History by Donna Tartt, often the most popular and lauded as one of the seminal or original dark academia texts that started the entire publishing trend. You get If We Were Villains by M.L. Rio, which utilizes Shakespeare quite heavily. Babel by R.F. Kuang, which is a very recent publication that soared to popularity. Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo. And all of these works contain the elements requisite for me to consider them dark academia. But another thing that these works and many, many other dark academia novels, if I were to list them all, we'd be here quite a bit longer than I think you want to. But they all rely on references. Now, what I mean when I say references here are call-outs, quotes, name-dropping characters from classic works of literature, often Greek, British, or American specifically. And it's classics, philosophy. Dark academia works heavily utilize these, almost as source texts. Now, this pattern isn't new. People reimagine and retell stories all of the time. TV shows, movies, poems, radio dramas. We recycle stories quite often. But dark academia tends to limit the scope in which stories they are recycling. And just as any show or piece of media that relies on reference, dark academia often relies on the fact that their audience, even if they're not familiar with the material, is familiar with the name. Now, like I said, there's a lot of dark academia novels that technically fall under this, and I wanted to not be working on my thesis for the next 30 years, so I had to limit my scope quite a bit. I had to narrow in my field of focus, and how I did that was I decided, after sifting through a lot of the available literature, that one, I wanted to pick works of dark academia that only used one primary source text. So that means that the work of the modern, more recent novel, it might reference a whole bunch of other texts, but it was relying on one primarily for all of the elements that it was reusing. With this in mind, that means that none of the books that I selected heavily rely on Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is one of the most prevalent authors referenced and echoed in dark academia. And when authors start pulling on Shakespeare, they don't limit themselves to just one of his works. So looking at Shakespeare's influence in dark academia is a whole nother branching conversation in and of itself. I elected to leave him out. So the DA works that I was looking for needed to borrow, like I said, a majority of the references from one other classic work. So I narrowed down my choices quite a bit, and there are still others that could fit this criteria, but like I said, I had a word and a time limit. So I ended up looking at four dark academia novels and also looking at their four primary source texts. And these dark academia novels are The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova, which is a 2005 publication, which exists quite heavily in conversation with Bram Stoker's Dracula. Conversion by Catherine Howe, which is a 2014 book, which is connected to The Crucible, a play by Arthur Miller. Plain Bad Heroines by Emily M. Danforth, which is a 2020 publication that relies quite heavily on the story of Mary MacLane. The story of Mary MacLane does also have an alternate title called I Await the Devil's Coming, just for information. And then last, but certainly not least, I have The Society for Soulless Girls by Laura Stephen. And that's a 2022, the most recent of the books. And the classic work that this is connected to is The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I'm looking at how the dark academia works interact with the pre-existing text, and I'm going to be using, for that, intertextuality. Now, for those that aren't familiar with intertextuality, it's a very broad field of literary theory. It's been around since about the 1960s, and under that term at the very least, and it has a multitude of definitions and subtopics. I'm using specifically hypertextuality, and when I say text, I mean a book. In intertextuality, text can sometimes have a varied list of definitions, and also how complicated the relation in between text can varies. But I specifically care about the source texts, which are the classic works, and the hypotext. And when I say hypotext, all that means is the recent dark academia text that is drawing from the sourced text. So the source text is the older work in question, if I use the word source text, and the hypotext is the text that relates back, so the modern dark academia work. All right, so now that that is covered, we have all our terms out of the way. You know what I mean when I say dark academia. If I say hypotext, you know exactly what I'm referring to. If I say source text, you know what I'm referring to. And you know what I mean when I say the Gothic. So let's actually dive into the hypotext. I am going to give you some comparisons, of course, to the source text, but I want to point out what all of these hypotexts have in common, aside from the fact that, of course, they're considered dark academia. And to begin with, all of them are written by women. Compared to the source texts, where the only one written by a woman is the story of Mary MacLane. Now, granted, the source texts were published in 1886, 1897, 1902, and 1953, respectively, so published women authors were quite a bit rarer. But that makes it even more interesting, the fact that all of the hypotexts are written by women. And after all, and I mentioned her work often, in her work on nostalgia and dark academia, Nguyen points out that a lot of dark academia authors are women in the modern publishing boom. And part of that is because the experience of women in higher education or on campuses has come into public conversation. You have things like assault, sexism, power structures, all of which women are highly concerned with because it can impact them quite negatively. And even in some of the dark academia novels that don't obviously address them, sometimes the avoidance feels even more powerful than the specific mention because it's happening, it's there, and all these other works are addressing it. So the author specifically choosing not to bring it up, the absence can be keenly felt. Now, women have a good reason, like I said, to hone in on writing these kind of stories in a dark academia setting, but the feeling of empowerment, being able to actually come forward to discuss these elements, are not the only reason, of course, that a lot of the more recent dark academia works are written by women. We have to also include things like the actual shift in publishing practice that allows more women to be published in the first place. Now, aside from author gender, all four of these works also have women as their primary characters. In Kostova, we have an unnamed narrator for the duration of the book, but it is a young woman we meet at age 16 and follow all the way through to her late 30s. And Kostova said that the reason that she chose such a young narrator is that she wanted to show her character maturing through her exposure through all of the different elements. And Kostova's book does emulate Dracula quite heavily in terms of format. It's epistolary. There's lots of letters, not all of which, of course, are written by our primary female narrator. There's a wide range of characters that are not women in The Historian. But conversely, when you look at the number of entries written by men in Dracula versus our primary young woman narrator in Kostova, it is a distinct difference. So Kostova adapted the format of Dracula, paid homage to it as an inspiration, but her adaptation of the work allows for a very different reading experience as we follow our primary narrator. And then we get to Conversion. Conversion is a young adult novel. It also has a female narrator, two, actually. Colleen Rowley, a high school student, starting college interviews and applications. And then also, and put no, who's called Ruth in Arthur Miller's The Crucible, who lives in the early 1700s during the Salem witch trials. Now, obviously, with two timelines, one in modern day and the other in the 1700s, we don't have a timeline overlap here. The two stories don't overlap in the way the different narratives and the historian do, but we do have our modern day narrator Colleen reading about Anne Putnam's trials, and she herself, as a student, is finding similarities in what is happening in her own world with what is happening in the Crucible. And of course, playing bad heroines. It deviates from the first person narration style. It's told primarily in third person, but we have Audrey Wells, Harper Harper, we have Merritt in the modern day film storyline. And then we also have an early 1900s murder mystery storyline with Flo, Clara, Libby, Alex, Eleanor. All of the perspectives we're getting in this book are from women. And in the Society of Soulless Girls, we once again have two primary narrators, but instead of the two narrators being in different timelines, we have two young women attending the same school at the same time. So we get a very much an overlapping story style. And they also act as romantic interests for each other. Gives us a very different perspective despite the similar narration style. Another thing all four of these works have in common, all four of these make use of their source text as a physical part of the retelling. The book Dracula pops up several times throughout the historian. In Conversion, Colleen Raleigh is writing a paper on the Crucible. In Danforth's Playing Bad Heroines, not only does she cite Mary MacLean's The Story of Mary MacLean near religiously throughout, but the book itself acts as a central part in a mysterious death, and the physical book keeps popping up again and again and again. It is everywhere. And then, similar to Conversion, in the Society for Soulless Girls, one of the main narrators is assigned Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for analysis work. So the worlds within these books have the source text as it existing as part of the self-contained literary canon. So the Dark Academia authors are recognizing these pre-existing works that they're using as sources have implications not only for us, the readers, as we go through these, but for the characters and the worlds within the page of the hypotext. Now, these authors use Dark Academia to investigate the source text. And why Dark Academia? They could have chosen to rewrite in a variety of different genres. But part of it is something specifically compelling about Dark Academia and how it relates to the idea of a text. Because the Dark Academia works rely somewhat on familiarity that readers might have with the source text. And books can be part of everyday life, but the academic setting really allows for a focus on the source text as an object and an inspiration that might not be present in a more casual setting. As I said, in Plain Bad Heroines, the physical book of the story of Mary MacLean is an object of curiosity because it pops up in multiple murders, but also an object of obsessive study and personalization. Not to mention a resource for self-expression amongst the characters in both the 20th and 21st century timelines. And in The Historian, Dracula shows up as a library book, but it's also in Count Dracula's own library, grouped, ironically, with some of the other biographies of the Count himself. And as I said, in The Society of Soulless Girls and in Conversion, it's assigned reading for a class extra credit. Now, all four of these hypotexts obviously utilize gothic and supernaturally inclined elements as well, but they do it in a slightly distinct manner. Vampires, very obviously, in Kostova's work. And not to mention, in the Society for Soulless Girls, we have mysterious science and almost Wiccan rituals, which is a change from the implied chemical science that we see in its source text, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And Howe relies quite a bit more on the unstated and the unseen, drawing on the paranoia from the early 1700s plot line to carry over that feeling of tenseness into the hysteria that is taking place in the modern day 21st century story. And of course, there's visual and place gothic elements as well. There's haunted schools in the Plain Bad Heroines, Brocante's School for Girls. There's the Wiccan rituals and the Society for Soulless Girls, as I mentioned. The actual physical locations, in most instances, have had some sort of mysterious death occur, the sole exception being the private school in Conversion, but there's still unknown and surprising illnesses popping up all over the place. So strong overt gothic elements in all of these works. And of course, They all take place in some version of a school. Conversion and the Society for Soulless Girls are actually at schools. Kostova relies more on academia settings as you bounce from higher education to library to archives. And Plain Bad Heroines, the modern storyline is filming at the same school that the early 20th century timeline has the murder and, well, mysterious deaths occurring at. So these are just some of the things they have in common. Now, the source texts as well do have some things in common. Very basic, they all have white authors. They are not all fiction. The story of Mary MacLane is actually unique in terms of the four source texts, as it's a work of nonfiction. It's a frank confessional style memoir. It's also the only one written by a woman, and it's the only one, as such, not strictly classified as gothic, since it is a memoir. That being said, it was written by a young woman and has a large propensity for doomed romance and an intense focus on nature that definitely gives it gothic elements, regardless of it being technically nonfiction. The Historian in Dracula. This is the direct comparison. They had a lot in common, like I said, the epistolary format. And there's also some differences. So there is arguments in scholarly circles on whether or not the count in Bram Stoker's work is meant to actually be Vlad Tepes. Now, in Kostova's work, he is. She has specifically done research and found even more information than Stoker would have had on hand to ensure that her version of Dracula is definitely Vlad Tepes. They're both also concerned with the element of invasion. Now, Dracula in the 1890s, it's British culture, it's colonialism, sexuality, religion, emerging modernity. There we go. Words. And all of this is almost seen as an invasion of Britishness. In The Historian, that's not necessarily the concern. You have young women and an older woman academic going in and out and learning, having access to all of this material. But the invasion occurring is more of the ivory tower than it is of the British Empire here. And there's also mutual themes of obsession in Dracula and the Historian that are echoed back at each other. Obsession, in the most part, over the pursuit of knowledge. The academic setting in the Historian, because it's not quite the same type of vampire hunt, really lets Kostova lean into that similar theme. And then when we get to Conversion and the Crucible, now the Crucible is a play, so it does have some formatting differences. But Conversion borrows a little more literally from its source text than Kostova did, because one of the storylines in Conversion is very literally a character in the Crucible. There's two storylines, the early 2000s and the 1700s. They have the same age narrator, and both are very much dealing with the concept of hysteria and paranoia. In the modern day timeline, it's schoolgirls falling ill, and of course, all the news. People that are hounding the school and the students trying to find out answers. And Colleen Rowe is, she's reading the Crucible and saying, "Once I found out that Anne Putnam said all the girls were faking in the Crucible, it just seemed so obvious that she could apply it to her own same circumstances." Not to mention, you have pressure kegs on the young women, very much. 1700s, early 2000s. They're both being pressured by outside and external powers to conform, to behave, to be the ideal of what a young woman should be at that time period. And then, of course, doubt and suspicion. Miller very much said that when he was writing The Crucible, he was inspired by the McCarthyism, the fact that it was no longer reasonable doubt, but reasonable suspicion that was driving everything, and how very adroitly takes the same paranoia and doubt and suspicion and unfolds it into the modern day timeline and has high school girls pointing at each other saying, no you, back and forth. And when we get to Plain Bad Heroines and the Story of Mary MacLane, like I said, the actual book, The Story of Mary MacLane, is quoted so often in Plain Bad Heroines that I count that as a definite similarity. And this is another dual time, dark academia work. The setting, Brokaw's School for Girls. Now, Brokaw's itself is not in the story of Mary MacLane, but she is of the exact age of the girls attending the school. And since it is a very in-depth memoir, it's a personal diary. She's exposing her private inmost thoughts to the public. In the 21st century, this film project, the director in power, all of the news crews following these famous actresses, they're attempting, and their goal is to get the private lives of these young women fit for public consumption. That is the entire point of the film that is being done in the 21st century. So you have this push and pull of the public versus private that is echoed in both works. And the concept of secrecy. Secrecy destroying. In the case of the story of Mary MacLaine, she feels it more as like these secrets have to get out. I cannot keep them in. And in Plain Bad Heroines, it is the keeping of these secrets that destroys so many of the relationships in both the 20th and 21st century timelines. And the idea of reputation. You have the reputation of an all-girls school in the 20th century, and you have the actual individual reputation of the actresses in the 21st. And like I said, last but definitely not least, we have the Society for Soulless Girls, and we have this strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, Society for Soulless Girls is actually longer. Jekyll and Hyde is a novella, but they're both honing in on this concept of duality. And in Society for Soulless Girls, this duality is almost a public versus private showing of the young women. What are they expected to do in public versus what do they think and do in private? And in Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it's what can a young man of high society be expected to act like in public versus what is he truly like in private? That social expectation very much drives the public and private lives of the characters in both of these works. And of course, they have murder in common. Now, that might seem fairly obvious, but it is actually a death in both cases that almost acts as the chrysalis or catalyst for the entire split personhood that becomes central to both of these stories. And anger is very integral to the split personhood in both stories, but in the Society for Soulless Girls, it's asking, why must female anger be private and not public? And in the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it was more saying, is anger a good or bad in terms of morality? So they handled it a little bit different, but the themes and topics exactly the same. Now, where does all this leave us? I gave a whole bunch of similarities in the hypotext, and then I drew comparisons between the hypotext and the source text. So I'm going to tie back into similarities again. Because, like I said, all four works of dark academia, those hypotexts, what they have in common is important because they're all things that show up again and again throughout dark academia as a genre. And female rage, it's there in all four. Very different, especially because the one that has it the least, the historian, it does have the narrator express anger at her father, but the majority of anger in the historian is reflected in the male characters, even when expressed by a woman. It's about a man's rage, which is interesting when you look at the other three books, where female rage is very much expressed on behalf of and because of the women. And Plain Bad Heroines has so many allegories with female rage and the actual wasps that buzz around. And the author has said this straight out in an interview, and other authors have pointed it out as well. The Society for Soulless Girls perhaps handles it in the most straightforward manner, whether you drink this ritual potion and it separates their anger out from their everyday person. And of course, conversion is a little more concerned whether it's morally right, but it's still there. All this concerned with female rage. And like I said, they're all female authors, so this definitely ties into that. All of the authors of these hypotexts have said that the reason that they are writing in dark academia is due to their personal experience with academia. And that is not limited to just these four texts. All the other texts I mentioned earlier, Babel, ML Rio's work, most female authors that have written in dark academia, you can find a soundbite interview somewhere that says, this was perhaps digging into my own experience in education or in a type of formal setting. ML Rio actually said in an interview, I spent 6 years getting a PhD only to spend the rest of my life convincing no one else they needed to. So the question of why these authors are choosing dark academia specifically ends up being a lot more individual than I initially assumed. Of course, this is not the sole reason, but it is important to note that a lot of them are very, very open about exactly why they are choosing dark academia as their genre of choice to do these retellings. And there was a dark academia anthology called In These Hallowed Halls, came out October of 2023. There was a lovely roundtable hosted with several of the authors. And again, these authors are saying guilt and darker concepts of the stratification of academia are the reason that we are writing dark academia. So, very much the current state of education inaccessibilities, the romanticization that gives false pretense to those coming in. There's so many real world reasons in academia that these authors are choosing to tell stories of disillusionment or specifically gothic works in this modern academic setting. And of course, beyond dark academia's concern with Western canon periods and classics, these 21st century authors intentionally utilize source texts with themes and elements that act in conjunction with their own concerns on academia. So the same questions that these classics are asking, the dark academia works are taking and asking again, just in different context. There's exact parallel questions in these source texts and in these hypotexts that are being asked not only of the characters and setting within the novel, but also of the readers that are devouring it. And of course, all of the books, works I selected had 21st century narrators, so it allows them to very much interrogate the existing time. And no novel ever asks just a single question of its context and its readers, but there's a reason that these dark academia authors are choosing to parallel from the specific source texts. And the 21st century young woman does make for a much freer narrator than the narrators that, even when they were men, are present in the time periods that the source texts were published. So the switch to a young adult female requires consideration of when and where a young woman would encounter a chance to express agency, or conversely, when she would receive pushback in the 21st century. So having that 21st century narrator, and specifically in these instances as young women, 21st century narrators, very much speaks to why dark academia. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Like I said, reusing classic works as frame for bringing the same questions into a different context has been done well outside of dark academia. Authors give myths breaths of new life again and again. You see Greek myths and superheroes. You see commercials referencing pre-existing works. Stories within stories are everywhere. But dark academia gives a structured power setting that authors can treat as a sandbox of sorts for inquiring minds on how new people and new places have altered responses to questions that are being asked again and again through literature. And my choice of using hypertextuality specifically here, like I said, it's just the beginning. These four works, these hypotexts, utilize classic works as source texts, but there's even more dark academia works that make use of an assortment of source texts in regard to plot, theme, atmosphere, character. And dark academia is only continuing to increase in popularity. The number of dark academia books coming out year after year stacks higher and higher. So the time's really ripe, I think, to dig into the genre and figuring out, with plenty of research, why now? Why these specific source texts? Not to mention a deeper look at the choice of female protagonists, I think would be a great research question. The impact of prevalent trends in any other topic in dark academia. It's a popular area for publishing, and new authors are taking their questions to the page with the dark academia setting in increasing numbers. And the more that are published, the easier it is to notice patterns as they begin to emerge. So, with that, thank you.
Well done indeed. Thank you, Laurel. And if you would like to leave your slide up here so your contact information and such can be there, that would be wonderful. Lots of applause here, lots of positive comments. I'd like to remind everyone that you can also use the Q&A to pose a question for Laurel. And I'd like to begin, if I may, and ask a question
Go
again.
ahead.
Well done and congratulations. I know as you went along, you sort of kept a file open of interesting ideas and provocative avenues you could go down that weren't quite on topic for this work, but were on topic for your exploration of dark academia. And I wondered if there was anything you'd like to tell us about that didn't make the thesis, but is something you plan to perhaps pursue later, some fascinating darling that you found that that
Oh.
didn't make it into the pages but is intriguing to you.
Oh, there's so many. I'll pick two. There's two that I'm definitely wanting to actively explore. If someone else gets them first, I would love to read it because then I don't have to do the work. But my document's actually, I think, approaching almost 3 pages now of parking lot ideas. But the two that I specifically am actively looking at is one, the use of tarot in dark academia. Because tarot in literature is a fascinating look. Like, tarot in literature has been used fairly often, and it often reflects like the understanding of tarot and social consciousness, what it is. And the fact that tarot actually isn't that old, it's like, is fascinating. And there's different types of tarot decks, so the uses that it's put to within the dark academia context and when it's chosen to be used outright versus just implied, what it means about the characters using it. Young adult versus adult using tarot. There's a lot of really interesting questions on how tarot is tying into the dark academia setting and character development, especially. And then the second one, oh gosh, there's so many. Vampires, libraries. Okay, water. The sea and dark academia. So A Study in Drowning by Ava Reid came out last year. A Dark and Drowning Tide by Alison Saft comes out this year. Curious Tides by Pascal. I'm gonna say the last name wrong. Lacelli came out in 2023 as well. And all three of those are da dark academia works that are obsessed with the theme in some way, shape, or form of the ocean and drowning. And they're all fantasy adjacent dark academia. And there's also works like Piranesi, where the sea and like the sea and how it is tied with the idea of essentially losing yourself in learning what it means to drown. Both in academia and outside of academia, those tie-ins are fascinating.
Thank you. If any of the attendees would like to pose a question, please put those in the Q&A. We already have one from Sarah Brown. Is dark academia having a moment right now? And if so, why is that?
I mean, I feel like it's been having a moment since 2016, a little bit. Granted, 2020 really kicked it up into like if it was already had like the foot on the gas pedal, 2020 floored it a little bit. Partially because everyone was stuck indoors and trying to decide what they thought was worth it. So it was a fascinating look, but it is definitely seeing a huge boom over the last couple years. But it's been around and publishing fairly steady since the early 2000s. Post 2016 has definitely been the largest jump, though, with 2020 definitely giving it some intense drive.
Good. Let's see. We've got another question for you here. I wonder if what awareness or critique there is about the genre, both being critical of academic culture while also potentially romanticizing it. I'm thinking about the aesthetics being so popular, even while we know that murder and sexism is less than great. Ah, good question there about the differences in the projects of the aesthetics and the literature.
Yes. And I think that's why the critique element is so integral to consider a work to be dark academia, because a lot of the stuffs that are romanticized in it are the problematic elements in academia. And I cited her a lot, but Mary Nguyen, she runs Fox. Which is
We have lost you for just a moment, Laurel. You seem to have frozen on us there. I don't know if it would help to. Oh dear, I'm sorry. I know you're there. It perhaps maybe take your video off for a moment and see if that, but you are currently frozen. Okay, so we have lost her. So let us pause for a moment. I'm going to go ahead and end our recording. And oh no, there she is. Good, excellent. I was going to pause it and come back, but you're back. Excellent. Good.
Sorry, my internet cut out.
It happens. Thank you for returning. So you were sort of mid-question there. So.
Yeah, but I was gonna say the reason I like it is because I like academia, but I've also been burned a little bit by academia. Majorly problematic. So I like the fact that we're looking at the problematic elements and finding out why are we still in love with this concept despite it having all of these problems? And it very much allows you to look at it and say, yes, all of this is problems. Here's who it's harming. And I think part of it's really useful to see all of that. Because academia should be open to all of it, and it's not. And it has some problems with power structure, elitism. So being able to see that reflected in literature, I think, is really important. And of course, there's always improvement to be done. Authors are human. But I think for the most part, there's some really good dark academia works out there that interrogate all of that.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for Laurel? This has been a fantastic experience here. Let's see. I believe, yes, and I will also be saving the chat. So if there's lots of love for the presentation. One more question. What is your next project? What is next on the drawing board for Laurel?
There's a lot of ongoing projects. If anyone knows me, I'm not great at doing one thing at a time. I've been trying to do a lot more with official reviewing of books. I have a academic book review coming out in Myth Lore for this next edition of a work on tarot, which is pretty interesting. But I'm trying to stay active with reviewing ongoing and current authors. And there's a chance of an essay collection in dark academia. I haven't decided if I'm actually going to put the time into assembling that yet, but there's interest in purchasing that collection if I decide to do that for anyone that's also researching in the area.
Fantastic. I bet that partially answers the question. Are you looking to publish this? Sounds like there's an opportunity that you may have a chance to have this in print. So.
There is. And I always love conferences. Like, aside from the ones that I run and I'm heavily biased to, I do enjoy presenting at conferences too. MPACA, the Mid-Atlantic Pop Culture Association, is one I go to somewhat regularly, because they have a lot of interesting topics too. So.
Wonderful. Another question for you. Do you have any advice for students who are about to embark on the thesis process?
I don't know, the most helpful thing to me was making regular appointments with my thesis advisor to keep me accountable for what it is I said I would actually do. Because if I say I will do something and then have no one checking in on me, I will remember I need to do it right before it is due, which is not ideal for large scale writing because I'm not a fast writer. So I made periodic check-ins and that worked well for me, but knowing how you work is probably the most important thing for keeping on track in thesis.
Excellent. Good. Anything else? Excellent advice. I see. Good. Comments here. Wonderful. Well, I personally congratulate you on a fantastic project and a fantastic presentation. And I hope you feel this as the celebration that it is. And I thank you for all that you have shared with us. And congratulations. And congratulations are blowing up in the chat. So with this, I want to thank everyone who attended. And I want to thank Laurel for this presentation and Signum University for making all of this happen. And with this, I will bid you all farewell, and we will end the recording here.